In an age of MP3s and cloud music libraries, some record stores in Kansas City still focus on the tangible object that is a record, an album on vinyl. On a recent morning, we met a young guy named Dave browsing the aisles at Mills Record Company. He likes records, but he doesn't have a record player.
I think vinyl is something for the newer generation to get involved in that I just completely support. Every genre is intermixed right now, you know. It's cool to be a hipster, you know, and every single genre is in. And so I think vinyl is one of those genres that is just in at the moment.
You said you didn't have a player, but do you have like a digital music collection, like CDs and MP3s and all that?
Yeah, I do.
And how do you typically store that? Or organize it?
Horribly. Horribly on days of emotions. I have emotion files.
And then we met Tom, who shares Dave's enthusiasm, but only listens to music on vinyl.
Well, I have some CDs left from when CDs were still being sold readily, but I don't have a CD player in my house. I just have a record player. So that's, I don't have a TV or internet at my house either, so that's kind of what I do. I'm very American in the fact that I'm materialistic, and I like to see the whole thing. I like to see the big packaging. Mm-hmm. I like to see the inserts. I like to see the extra stuff that comes with them. And then, you know, I also collect stuff that is not available anymore, stuff like that.
It's a confusing time to be a music collector, as our intern Patrick discovered while talking to people like Dave and Tom at the record store. What's old is new, what's new is new. And music is available in so many formats it could make your head spin. On the other hand, there's something for everyone? I'm Gina Kaufman. Here to help us organize our thoughts on music collecting on Central Standard this morning is Chuck Haddix. He's the host of The Fish Fry every Friday and Saturday night here on KCUR, and he's the director of UMKC's Mars Sound Archive. Hi, Chuck.
Gina, it's good to be here with you.
It's great to have you. How long have you been collecting records?
Well, I'm going to date myself here. The first record I bought was 1967. It was Otis Redding, Carla Thomas, the King and Queen of Soul.
Nice choice.
Yes, and it was. I was really into Otis Redding at that time. And I bought it, I think, at Walmart, and I paid $2.99 for it.
You said you were going to date yourself, but you didn't tell us how old you were.
Well, I was 16 at the time. I'd been collecting records a little bit before that, but mostly gift records from other people. I just didn't have any money, and I started working. As soon as I started working when I was 16, I began investing in vinyl. And started collecting all over. I'd go downtown to Mr. Z's. Cats Records down – I grew up north of the river, and Cats Records had a killer record – Cats Drugs, or rather, had a killer record selection, 45s and LPs. I collected 45s a little bit, but I really gravitated more towards the LPs, particularly after the Beatles started putting out their thematic albums.
Why do you think you gravitated toward the LPs?
I think you get more bang for your buck. You know, you paid it like 75 cents for a 45, and if you bought a record $3, you could, in a Kinks greatest hits, you had all their hits there. And I don't know, there's something about it. And also you get the graphics with the LP. You know, in those days there's no fanzines hardly. That's you know, pre-Rolling Stone. And so any information that you would get about an artist, chances are you had to go to the album.
Chuck, I've heard you say on The Fish Fry that your record collection weighs so much that it cracked the foundation of your house and that you had to move it to the basement.
Yeah, well, I lived on 5412 Charlotte. My background is the record industry. I started out working for a one-stop called Friends 2. And then I worked for House Distributors, which distributed small labels, and I managed Penny Lane Records, and I worked for the Music Exchange for a while. So over the years, I became a what Don Mayberger calls a promosexual. I started collecting promos quite heavily. So, you know, and when you work in the record business, you get a lot of freebies. And so – and also I buy records, and I'd go to thrift stores and all that. Now, when I lived at 5412 Charlotte – the house began to sag under the weight of – I had my record collection in the dining room, you know, covering two walls. And that's where I used to do the fish fry when I first started doing the fish fry.
From your dining room?
No, I'd write out my program.
Gotcha.
And I'd have kids running through there all the time. And then the house began to sag, so we moved it downstairs to the basement. And now I live in South Kansas City on Holly Street, 97th Holly, and the records are still in the basement. It's always in the basement.
That, but that's a pretty heavy record collection to weigh more than a normal amount of furniture, say.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's that, you know, it's the, well, the Mars Sound Archives is located, it's 350,000 sound recordings in the sound archive. It's located on the ground floor of the Miller Nichols Library for good reason. When we got started, we were on the second floor, and when we moved to the ground floor in 92, they discovered cracks in the building from the weight. So it's not heavy, it's my records.
Do you listen to music in other formats too, or is it all vinyl all the time?
Usually if I'm at home, I'll listen to vinyl. I have two turntables, one set up downstairs and a set up in the front room. I listen to vinyl a lot. I listen to CDs too. I'm not a music snob that way, but I prefer to listen to LPs. There's something about an LP. I was doing every year this time I play Autumn Song by Van Morrison on Fish Fry, and I was doing a book talk up in Kearney, and this guy came up to me and goes, "I love it when you play that." He goes, "You can hear the clicks in the record. That's really part of the charm." You know, I thought, boy, better replace that one.
Do you think, though, that, I mean, the clicks on your record are different from the clicks on someone else's record? Do you come to hear that as part of the music? And, like, almost when you hear a new version of a song you've listened to a lot, sometimes, even if the new version is great, it's just your expectations are set up to hear a certain thing and it's never going to be the same. Do you have that with the imperfections in your records?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I can always tell. It's kind of funny because for a while I had to mothball my records. I was working for CDs with CDs on the Fish Fry. And Shirley May Owens, who's a friend of ours that was also a broadcaster on KKFI, when I brought my records in again and started playing them, she goes, "Yeah, Chuck's got his record collection back. I can hear a few clicks there."
Well, we're also joined this morning by Judy Mills. She owns Mills Record Company in Westport. That's the record store we visited earlier in the show. Hi, Judy.
Hey, how are you, Gina?
Great. How are you?
Thank you. Good.
Well, one of the people that our intern met at your store was a young man who seemed to feel that records are really for the younger generation, which maybe isn't historically how we think about these things. Do you think that that's the case? Is it primarily young people seeking out vinyl at your store?
No, not at all. I mean, it's charming that they believe that. And I think a lot of them feel like they discovered vinyl for the first time. And they feel like their dads still suck on CDs. And so I think that's really cute how they are feeling like they discover it. But I love that they do. And there definitely is the boomers have never left vinyl. And so they're being joined again by the millennials. So I'd have to say, if I ever look around in the store, there's all different demographics in the store.
When did you open your store?
It was a year ago in May, so about a year and a half ago.
What motivated you to do that when so much news about brick and mortar music stores, record stores, has been of the doom and gloom variety?
Right. Well, a couple things on that. I think, honestly, it was the right time for me because I had worked in corporate retail for a long time, and I decided I couldn't do that any longer, and I just needed to do something from a more passionate standpoint. And I also really felt like there needed to be a place to buy new vinyl in Kansas City.
And talk about new vinyl a little bit, because that seems to be kind of your focus and your niche. Is that a different customer and a different concept from the crate digging for a hidden gem at an estate sale or on eBay or something?
Absolutely. And, you know, I will say now that we have two sides of the store, and we have both sides. But we initially started with new vinyl because that's what you couldn't find in Kansas City at the time. And people still ask me, "They make records these days? I didn't know they still make records." I hear that question a lot. And I always say that if you've noticed on the late night shows, they don't hold up a CD anymore. They hold up, they hold up a vinyl record.
Why do you think that is?
Because that's the preferred format, for sure. That's the coveted format, and it is definitely the preferred format.
Is there something about the sonic quality of the album on vinyl that is preferable, or is there something of a fad quality to it?
Well, I mean, there's definitely something about the sound, for sure. But there's also, it's an event, and it's a happening, and it's an aesthetic choice. I was mentioning, the ability to hold the art, to see the art, to engage with it. And there's a lot of really creative things that are being put out with records these days. And it really appeals to, I think, a lot of the millennials, because it's part of the experience. To a generation that doesn't like to buy things, they will if they can get an experience around it. And vinyl offers that experience.
That makes sense. What do you think is the relationship between vinyl and new artists creating their new music? I noticed And not only the vinyl, but the relationship between the vinyl and the digital offerings. I noticed on the new St. Vincent album being sold in record stores that there's a sticker on the cover that's offering a free download with purchase. That seems like these are very intermingled offerings for new musicians.
Well, because I think as long as you've got automobiles and you have treadmills, you're going to have downloads. You're going to have some sort of, you know, shuffle, iPod sort of situation or streaming music, because you can't take your, you can't take your turntable into the car or into the gym. So I just think it makes sense. Vinyl is never going to be the sole format that it was back in the day.
I know this is a tangent, but they have those the record players that are portable that you can plug into the car, but I don't really know how that would work because it would scratch the record if you're driving. But go on. Please carry on with the actual point you were making.
No, that's good. So I just think that's the reality. I think that more that artists and the record industry or the music industry can understand the realities and mesh the two together, the better it's going to be for the livelihood. That vinyl will be less of a fad than it will be a real transition.
How do you feel about the digital music options and online subscriptions like Spotify?
Well, Spotify, is definitely, there is a lot of controversy around it. Just yesterday, Taylor Swift announced that she's going to pull off of Spotify. So I just think it's a reality that you can work it in many different directions. And if you're a new artist, you're excited to get your item on, your album on Spotify, because then so many people can hear you. So I think it's a real opportunity, and it's a reality that I work with every single day, because there are some customers I know well enough to say, you need to take this home with you. You're going to love this record. But some I don't quite know well enough, and I'll give them, go listen to this and this. And then the opportunity to be able to hear a record in its entirety will convince them to actually buy it.
When it comes to that Taylor Swift news, our local music critic Tim Finn wrote in the Kansas City Star an article about that. And he quoted a local band, the Grizzly Hand, about that the exposure they had gotten on Spotify was great, but that they had gotten about $10 for 10,000 plays.
Right.
That's not a great net profit.
No, it's absolutely not. I mean, but it's a reality as well. Like, if I had a choice, if Spotify existed or not, I would certainly have an opinion on that. But as long as it does exist, and I operate every day in a facility where I sell physical music, I'm going to use that to help the artist by selling their record.
How do you organize your own music library?
I completely can understand the gentleman who we were listening to talking about it. There's just no way it's very difficult. It's very time consuming.
Yeah, he said he does it horribly.
Yes, exactly. And I have a friend who, I won't name her name, but she spends every Sunday morning updating her iPod and her phone and her music files. And I just don't have that interest. And I have left more iTunes accounts behind me than I have men in the last 10 years. And I'm just done with that part of it. And so I stream online, and or I buy the vinyl and listen to the vinyl. And it just eliminates a lot of the download fussing with.
Chuck Haddix, as someone who runs a sound archive, you must think really long term about not only preserving the recordings that already exist, but also ensuring that people in the future will be able to listen to them. What does that mean on a practical level?
Well, for LPs and 78s and cylinders, it's just storing them properly, because those formats will outlast any digital file. All the music you have on your phone is probably not going to be there in a couple of years. You're going to lose it. But for items like instantaneous cut discs that are cellulose acetate over metal base or glass base or open reel tape, what we do, we have two preservation studios for audio and one preservation studio for video we're developing now. We record them as WAV files into the computer, and then using FTP protocol, we move them to the server farm in Colombia, those archival files, where they're stored in deep storage. And then we'll make an MP3 or burn a CD for patrons to listen to. That's the way we preserve things in our collection. We do not use compressed files. A WAV file has become like the de facto standard. But they're huge, so you have to have big storage, and that's why we use MU.
What do you think your choices at the Mars Sound Archive can tell us about the future of the music collection for the average person? Or can it tell us anything about that? Do you think the idea of what it means to have a music collection is undergoing a dramatic change?
Well, yeah, it is. I first started out in 1987, and that's, CDs came along shortly after that, so we were able to benefit from that. You know, a lot of the items in the Sound Archive are unique. Like, we have 30,000 16-inch radio programs, 16-inch disc radio programs, and those are unique recordings, particularly the material from World War II. So the Sound Archive, we collect America's cultural music history and make it available to people. That's what we do, by cataloging it and by preserving it. And in the future, the problem is the record labels have been compromised. They're going out of business. They're not reissuing things. They're not making things available now either. It used to be the big labels controlled everything, and now it's the web's very democratic. And so individuals now, like bands like Grizzly Hand or Maria the Mexican, put out their.
It'll be in the band's hands in some.
Yeah,
sense.
Yeah. The consumers control the music, and that began with Netflix.
Well, Central Standard is going to take a quick break. Call 816-235-2888 to talk about how you build and organize your music collection in an era of seemingly infinite options, and share your tips for aspiring record collectors in the Kansas City area. 816-235-2888. We'll also hear from Alan Henry at Lifehacker. Stay tuned. Let's continue our conversation about music geekdom in the 21st century. I'm Gina Kaufman. So far this morning, we've been hearing the insights of Chuck Haddix, best known for the Friday and Saturday Night Fish Fry, and Judy Mills, who owns Mills Record Company in Westport. Soon, we're going to turn to Alan Henry, with us by Skype from Lifehacker. But first, I want to pick back up with Chuck where we left off, about how changes in the music industry translate to changes in the idea of what it is to be a music collector and to have a music collection.
Well, it used to be in the old days when I first started out, you had 45s, cassettes, and LPs. And the major labels really, really ruled the roost. Warner Brothers, CBS, Capitol, MCA all had offices here. And you had the evolution of these big record stores like Peaches, like Penny Lane, like Streetside, and then and Capers Corners too. And then what happened was, with file sharing, when file sharing came about, it devastated the record business because people were no longer paying for music. And also, digital enables us to share files. I mean, if somebody contacts us at the Sound Archive and they're interested in something, we can make it available to them digitally, no matter where they are in the world now, and individual and peered sharing too. And the record labels did not get current with that technology. They fought it tooth and nail when they should have bought into it and made digital files available and charged people for it, like Spotify does or some of the other services. And so they were in decline, and conversely, the record labels, the big record stores began to shut down. Peaches, Streetside, they just could no longer sustain it, make money by selling the object itself when it's available digitally. And so the consumers really took charge of the distribution of music away from, and small entrepreneurs away from, the big major labels. It marked quite a change in the way business is being done. But what's interesting is we're seeing this revival in vinyl now. If you look at the stores around town, it used to be that you could go buy CDs. You still can. There's a few of them. But mostly it's used CDs, new vinyl, and used vinyl. That's what rules the roost now. So there's a niche market for it now.
So, Judy, how does it feel to you to listen to this history of the record industry and to be going – you're not going against the grain as far as popularity and vinyl, but as far as the fate of the record store, certainly.
Well, I still think that, there is a resurgence in vinyl, and it's, up 50% over last year. We're going to end at 8 million units probably at the end of the year. That's still a teeny tiny slice of the overall market. I do think it speaks a lot that that album sales are down, but record sales are up, and I think that speaks to the diversification of of the music industry that you can have more people are releasing things that and but are not having the large hits. So
when you say album sales are down, you mean that's across formats when you pull
right.
all the formats. So CDs, digital, and records put together. But in records, they're up.
Uh-huh.
That
for
is
sure.
pretty fascinating.
So but I still feel like vinyl is the underdog, and some you know, there, and there's a very specific customer who wants to buy physical music still, and then there's even within that customer, there's a subset of people who want to buy vinyl music and or music on vinyl, and that's the customer I'm there to support. And I guess in some sense we're kind of the underdog, but I always love to support the underdog.
Well, let's turn now to Alan Henry. He's with us by Skype from Lifehacker. Hi, Alan.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So how do you personally navigate the many options out there for collecting, storing, and enjoying music?
I can't get enough, actually. I'm not one of those kinds of people who has one particular method that I use for kind of consuming all of my music. I, too, have a pair of record players and lots of vinyl sitting in crates right under the turntables over there. And then I also have some CDs. And when I'm working or I'm just heading around town, I do a lot of streaming. So it's one of those things where whichever format is kind of most conducive to where I am is the format that I go for.
We've been a little bit maybe down on CDs so far in this conversation. Do you still listen to CDs? Do you still buy them? Albums
I
on
do.
CD?
I do, actually. I buy a lot of music on CD that I can't get on vinyl, for one, because I'm totally that guy who loves – I love records. I've been buying records since I was a teenager, and I can't get enough of them aside from, you know, my foundation's not cracking because I have so much vinyl. But the wood flooring in my apartment certainly is, and when I move, it's going to be a nightmare. But I do buy CDs largely because I enjoy having – a physical copy of my music that I own that I can do virtually anything with. So if I want to put it on my phone, I take that copy, like we were saying earlier, that WAV files, for example, they're lossless files. They're the now kind of de facto best version that you can get of a particular piece of music. So by owning the CD, I can then put that CD in my computer. I can rip a WAV file from it, and I can change it into any other format that I may want that's more conducive to, you know, the size of my phone or the device I'm carrying around town, and then I can listen to it on the go. When I'm sitting here at my computer, then I can listen to the lossless version right on my computer, and I do all this without really even using a CD player. I mean, I can put it in my computer and listen to it directly, but usually I take it and I back it up for my own use, and then I'll put it on whatever else I want to listen to it on.
So what is the difference sonically and technologically between the different options? We've talked about the WAV file as the best
yeah.
version. Why is that?
Well, WAV is kind of the best version because it's the closest, call it bit by bit version of what's on the CD. And what's on the CD is kind of the closest duplicate to the recorded version that you can get in a consumer format. So if you have a version that's as close to the original and isn't compressed, it doesn't trade bits of information for the amount of space you're going to put it on. That's how you, when you have that perfect copy, you know you're getting all of the audio that went into the recording and you don't remove anything that in turn would result in a poor listening experience. WAV is one of those files. There are lots of others. There's FLAC, OGG. OGG is the one that Wikipedia likes to use for its archival music. But the process of converting and choosing things like bit rates, which you know that is the indicator for the level of quality of music that that you have as far as the file size is concerned, is more the more you shrink the file to fit on portable devices or any device, the more you trade off the actual sound for it. Some people can't hear it, but some people can.
I want to jump in because Chuck Haddix is nodding along here. And Chuck, you bring a heavy crate full of records in here for your fish fry broadcasts. And I'm, I guess, surprised to see you nodding along about the perfection of these other versions.
Well, you know, LPs, there's a People, we're talking about record collectors here. People collect records for a lot of different reasons. The new vinyl, for example, is sonically superior to the CDs. Mm-hmm. You know, they cut off the high ends and the low ends in the CDs, and it tricks your ears that you're hearing something there when it's not there. If you put an LP, like a Maria the Mexican LP, next to the CD, I'll take the LP every time because it sounds warmer. And it has an expanded range sonically too, and the notes come together above what we can hear to create harmonics that give the recording a warmth to it. Chad Kasem out at Analog Productions has one of the few record pressing plants in the country out in Salina, Kansas. And when you go out there and listen to his setup, it is just unbelievable. And so you've got people that are audiophiles that have high-end turntables, and they collect records. And you also have people that collect records for the value of records. You know, a Beetle Butcher cover or John Coltrane's mono version of Blue Train is worth a lot of money.
Chuck, when you talk about warmth, I feel like I understand what you mean, but can you describe in more concrete terms what you mean by warmth in a recording?
Well, yeah, you can. It is the digital to me sounds brittle. I mean, I do both. I have both CDs and LPs on the fish fry, and you can hear the spatial arrangements of the instruments. It's like you're there. Where digital it's still not arrived quite yet. It still sounds a little brittle to me.
Alan, what do you think about what you're hearing here?
I completely agree. I can't. There's nothing else to say. But I'm a kind of a headphone enthusiast. So I'm one of those guys. I love to, like, I'll plug my headphones in and sit right next to my turntables and I'll just listen to the music, which is something a lot of people don't do a lot of anymore. Unfortunately.
Yeah. Why put the headphones into the turntable rather than just listen on the speakers?
Well, so there's a lot of things that go on when you're listening to music in a space. I mean, the dynamics of the space play a role. And it's all acoustics, right? But some people, again, a lot of people don't care. But I think in a way, part of the reason that part of the fuel in the record buying culture, again, is this kind of audiophile movement. There's a lot of people who are saying, wow, I can hear things in this pair of headphones, or I can hear things when I listen to a record that I can't hear when I listen to this MP3, or I can't hear when I'm listening to Spotify, and I like what I hear. Because I'm a headphone enthusiast, call that soundstage. That the ability to hear the division between individual instruments, as opposed to it all kind of muddling together. When you're talking about warmth, that's the thing that comes to my mind. I can close my eyes and I can see I can see the band members on stage. If I focus on the lead guitar, I can hear them. Or if I focus on the guy playing the standing bass, I can hear that. And when you listen to a digital copy of just about anything, even if it's a really well ripped one or art, high quality, you still lose some of those things. And if you listen to a CD, you get kind of the best version you can get as far as whatever you can get, like at Amazon or someplace like that. But if you really have access to a vinyl copy, it's a whole different listening experience that I think a lot of people like me. I mean, I'm not. You know, that old, but I remember when vinyl was everywhere and you could go to any department store and buy it, although it was on its way out when I was starting to buy my own music. And I miss that. And I think a lot of people are being reintroduced to that level of quality, that reintroduced to what their favorite musicians can sound like. And they like what they hear.
As fast as technology changes, and this is something that you've written about, how can we build and organize our music collections intelligently and also make sure we're still able to play this stuff when everything changes again? Because this whole thing about change being the only constant certainly seems to be true.
Yeah, it's a tricky problem to solve because unfortunately, most consumers don't have access to high-level kind of archiving systems that that real music collectors that spend lots of money or radio stations or libraries and like Wikipedia or archive.org have access to. Most of us, there's two kind of sides of that, right? The one side is how can we make sure that we have it for the long haul? Well, the best thing you can do is kind of back up your information in as multiple places as possible and try to use the most lossless, the most kind of true to the original versions of those files as possible.
This term and, lossless has come up a lot. Would you mind defining it?
I'm sorry. Yeah. Lossless is kind of the, like we were saying earlier, if you put a CD in your computer, you want to take the bit-by-bit copy, the most exact copy to what your source material is, without compressing it, without changing it, or without removing information in order to make it fit into a specific file size. So if you get the most exact copy, that's a lossless file. If you are converting it to something like MP3, and MP3 is by definition a lossy format, it's designed to be smaller than what you have on a CD because it's going on something like an iPod or a smartphone that has limited space. So if you take those files in the most true to the original format as possible and then back them up on your own computer and then back them up somewhere away from your computer, then you will at least have copies that will go with you and stand the test of time as far as your electronics are concerned. That way, I mean, one thing that I like to see is that a lot of these companies like Microsoft and Google and Apple and Dropbox, they're essentially giving away storage in their own data centers to anybody who signs up for, you know, their services, or like Microsoft gives away storage to online for people who use Microsoft Office, and that's pretty much everyone. So you can then back that stuff up in their data center. Let them handle it. Let them make sure that it stays in one place while you have your own copy. And then you have the original physical copy, like your CD or your vinyl, that you will hold on to for as long as you can. And if something happens, then you always have those copies somewhere else on the internet that another company has backed up to make sure that you don't lose everything. You'll always have some version.
So it's a best of both worlds. Like the record is the object that provides you the sentimental value, the warmth, the big cover art and all of that, and then you have the lightness and indestructibility in a certain sense of the digital world.
Yeah, it's not perfect, obviously, but because I mean, in the future we may not have those services may shut down, or the newer device that lists that everybody uses to listen to their music may not support the files that you have, but at least you'll have enough copies of your beloved music collection that you can then you can twist it and rip it again or change format so you can always have it with you.
I'll admit it sounds maddening to me to keep copying and refiling and all of that. But Chuck, yeah. it looks like Chuck wants to jump in here.
Well, you know, when you compress a file, you're stripping away bits of information to shrink the file. And that's why MP3s are a pale shade to the original. Mm-hmm. I always call it putting on your belt and suspenders. That's why we back up all of our files, our archival files at MU, where they're stored in deep storage. That's what you have to do. And these companies do us a wonderful service by making it available. The main thing, though, is people want to have their music on the go. You know, that's the beauty of four-track tapes and then eight-track tapes and then cassettes. Yep. You know, you had a cassette player in your car, man, you were in tall cotton. You know, the whole concept of mixtapes, you know, that movie High Fidelity is like the story of my life in so many different ways, making mixtapes for your girlfriend or your friend.
Has that fallen out of, like, is that a thing people still do? Or is the whole idea of the labor of love of constructing a curated, like, individualized music thing, has that lost its specialness?
I don't think it's lost its specialness at all, because it always means a lot when somebody took the time. And I mean, I've fallen in love with somebody over a mixtape. Like, oh, he did that for me. I mean,
but now you can search the term love in your music library and turn up like that.
Absolutely. I mean, it's yeah. But I do. I think that's still special because it just doesn't happen very much anymore, you know. And it is easier to do it now, so that takes out some of the specialness. But I do feel like some people still do that.
So back to this. Oh, sorry. Go on, Alan.
No, I was just going to say there's a very kind of, it's not really underground, but there's a couple of services on the web that do streaming music that are specifically for this, and they're explosive with wonderful music. I mean, 8-Tracks is one of these sites that is all music playlists, and it's playlists created by individuals for specific moods, and they're trying to communicate their feelings, or they're trying to share a specific kind of, I mean, the same way when we used to make mixtapes, they're trying to send a message, or they're trying to tell a story with their music selections. There's that. And I subscribe to another music service that every Monday, it's called Noon Pacific, because every Monday at Noon Pacific, they send you a curated playlist of all of this new music that they think is really worth sharing. There's some sneakiness in there. There's some people who are starting to bubble that back up to the surface, because I don't think playlist culture is dead yet. I think there are a lot of people who are saying, you know, I can tell stories with my music, and I like being able to do that.
Well, let's get back to this question of the future of the music collection. What I want each of you to talk a little bit about this. What is the future of the music collection as a cultural phenomenon? With records, so much care and personal pride go into a collection, and not to mention the luck of the find. Are those aspects of the music collection in danger of becoming obsolete? And if so, what takes their place? Judy, let's start with you.
So the question is, what's the future of collecting?
Yeah.
I don't think we can predict that. Every time I go to contemplate like where we're going to end up in 20 years, I think of how excited people were about CDs and this picture of them holding up a CD for the first time. I'm like, oh, this is going to change things. And now look where we are. So I think that people are always going to want to collect music that they love, and that's never going to go away. I think that streaming is definitely the wave of the future. Even the classic iPod is not being made anymore. So and so many millions of people stream music now, and that's definitely something that's going to have to be dealt with, and it's not going away.
Chuck?
I agree. I think there will always be a people who will collect the objects, people that will want those Northern Soul 45s, that collect blues 78s, that collect very specific things, and people that just go in because they like to play records and they want to go see Judy and hang out at the store and collect it. But I think the future is digital, and I think it's streaming. I mean, from my perspective as a broadcaster, it used to be to where our signal just went out, you know, 100 miles or so. Now I've got listeners in Japan. I've got people listen to me in New York, all over the country, Atlanta, Texas. And also there's over 2,000 hours of archive fish fry programming available, well, whenever you want it. All you got to do to go to kcur.org, and you can hear me flub through the last hour of Friday night show. And as far as playlists are concerned, it's kind of funny because, you know, I program 128 records or discs each weekend, 64 tracks in a fish fry, and I go in and I craft it very carefully. Sometimes it's music to get your backfield in motion. Sometimes it's music for what Bob Hammond at KN used to say, enhancing your romancing. I think the playlist, the music, the main thing is the music, whatever format you use it, however you consume it, is going to evolve. But the main thing is the music.
Alan, what are you hearing here, and especially this issue of the luck of the find?
Yeah, I think that, like everybody else has said, that people are going to find music that they love. They're going to find it in the formats that they love. They're going to find it in the music that's really special to them. They're going to go out and they're going to buy it in different formats or better formats in ways that they think are really, really special to them. But I don't think that the luck of the find is quite gone yet. I think that when, especially as we were saying, this kind of audiophile culture, this crate flipping culture starts to rise again. I mean, I'm one of those guys who loves my local secondhand stores and record stores, and I go or even my local thrift stores, I will go and spend hours just flipping through their records, looking at things that I would never buy, but I'm looking at them and I'm like, I feel like I have to have this because it's here. You know, like
it's almost like going to a museum or something, though, it sounds like.
Exactly. And to a certain extent, I feel like I want to take it home with me to keep it safe. Like, it can't stay here, you know, but I think that a lot of people are going to continue to do that. And they're going to continue to dig through those crates and say, wow, I can't believe that this artist that I love so much released this on vinyl. I have to have this. I already have it on my computer at home, but I really want to have this too.
Central Standard is going to take one more break. Call 816-235-2888 to join today's conversation. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. And we're back. You can still get in on this conversation, 235-2888 in the 816 area code. We've got tricks and tips for building, organizing, and enjoying a music library, given all the options out there today. We're talking with Chuck Haddix of the Fish Fry and Mars Sound Archive, Judy Mills of Mills Record Company, and Alan Henry of Lifehacker. And Chuck, I want to turn to you now. There's a new compilation out by Numero Records. Last year, they re-released some old Kansas City funk music, and now they're releasing for the first time previously unissued recordings of underground Kansas City music, literally underground. It's music created for 6 years in Missouri's limestone mines. What do you know about this project?
You know, I don't know too much about that project. I think it's referring to the Cavern studio. And there, a lot of groups would go in during the 1960s and record their music in Cavern Studios. And they're releasing the master tapes on that. And there was a whole underground – you see it pop up on Facebook. Like, for example, Alan Blasco played in a lot of those groups. So, you know, they're making that available. It's amazing what they're doing in general. Last year they did the Forte Story, which is a small label here in Kansas City. Marva Whitney was involved in, and those are some of the rarest records made. I mean, they sell for thousands of dollars in the Northern Soul circuit. And they take and they curate specific labels, and they do a wonderful job all over the country. And it's nice seeing that stuff come up. They did the Titan label too, which was a label here, a pop label, mm-hmm. in the 1980s when I was working in the record business. So they're making music available that's been lost. It's almost like they're archaeologists.
Let's give a listen to a track from this new album, Local Customs Cavern Sound. This track is Montaris. How do re-releases of old recordings fit in with the big picture? As technology evolves and with it the music collector and the general audience, why do this?
Well, you know, it's making recordings available that would not be available otherwise, particularly in rare stuff like the Cavern recordings. Jack White has a label called Third Man Records, and he goes back and he's reissuing all the Paramount records. I worked on that project too. And they go back in and they remaster it and make it available with these historic recordings, because sometimes previous issues were sonically inferior. And they've got the technology now to redo them. And it's just amazing. But here, this is all underground stuff that they're making available to everybody. And they do a wonderful job. Those guys they're record dogs, man. They came into the Sound Archive, and I had they looked through the 45 collection, and they knew exactly what they were looking for.
Why does it – can you hear when you hear that it was recorded in the specific kind of place in the limestone mines?
You know, the music of each city is defined by the rhythm section and by – the studios that recorded them. When you think about the Memphis Sound, you think about Stax. When you think about Muscle Shoals, you think about those great Wilson Pickett recordings, those great Aretha Franklin recordings, Alan Toussaint, the St. Steve's studio down in New Orleans. The studio really defines how the sound is and captures that kind of rawness of that performance. That was wonderful.
We had a caller earlier who didn't stay on the line but wanted us to ask where you get a record player now. And Judy, maybe you can answer that for us, because maybe some people are listening and have been sold on this idea but no longer have a turntable.
Sure. Well, obviously I can help you with that. But there's also all kinds of great vintage. You can still get great vintage players. You can get super high-end players. We offer an introductory one. And so there's quite a few places, and I'd be happy to, you know, point them in the right direction based on their needs.
You can buy them on the internet. I use an MK1200 here. There's two turntables in the studio there that I use every Friday and Saturday night. I use the MK1200s because you can back cue them. That's what DJs use. But I use a Project Audiophile turntable at home. You can buy those for like $400 or $500, and they're wonderful. They sound great.
Uh-huh. You can start with like a great Audio Technica for even just like $150. It's a great starter one.
So we have another caller who I want to turn to now. Let's talk to Lisa in Leawood.
Hi, good morning. First of all, thank you for the great program. I love listening in. But just a quick question for you. I have got my mother's record collection from the 1940s, and it's probably almost 100 albums. I call them albums, but they're smaller, but not as small as like a 45. And I'm just wondering, do you have any suggestions on, like, for example, donating that collection or what I could possibly do with it?
Okay, let's get some advice for Lisa.
Well, you know, it just depends on the nature of it. You know, at the Sound Archive, our collection is built from gifts. This is a call I get all day long. Why don't you give me a call at the Sound Archive at area code 816-235-2798. We'll talk about it and see if we can't provide a home for your mother's collection.
Chuck, you're just giving out your phone number on the radio. I love that.
Well, when you call the Sound Archive, I'm the one that answers it too. So that's all right. I mean, you know, people should be able to call me. Right. I'm enlisted in the phone book, Gina.
I do have a question that's sort of related to what Lisa's asked. I am an inheritor of records in my family just by default of being the last one with a record player. And I have like my grandpa's records, and he died when I was very young, but I get to kind of spend some time with him by playing his records. Do you think that people will look into their relatives' digital desktops with that same kind of relationship, or is that going to be a kind of different thing, a different way of relating through music?
I think they will. I think they'll rummage around the old digital desktop and listen to what pop was listening to back then. You know, you can tell a lot about the person. I can tell you a lot about a person by looking at their record collection, their interests, and what they are collecting. And that's a way of connecting to that individual. And if it's a relative, you want that direct connection.
And I think it's interesting because, you know, for example, though, computers have a much shorter life. And so unless they are backed up, you know, they're not going to be around 20 years to rummage mm-hmm. through because of the nature of that technology. But if it's backed up correctly and you're in a cloud and so forth, for sure. But there's something about physically touching something that, you know, your loved one touched also.
Let's talk to Ryan and Gardner. Hi, Ryan.
Hi there. Hey, great show. I have a question, I guess, for Judy. So when I want to buy new vinyl, one of the things that I get worried about is if that vinyl has been, you know, washed so many times, especially if I want to buy, you know, older vinyl, but a new vinyl from an older, you know, Beatles or something like that. And I want to make sure that it's from the original pressing. What are your thoughts on kind of on that issue? Does it mean anything? And what can I look for to make sure that I'm getting, you know, the original quality that, you know, my parents got?
No, that's a really good question, actually. And one of the things that you can do is do a little research on that pressing. For example, a lot of the Beatles just were reissued on mono, and they've gotten great reviews about in terms of that pressing. It does sound really good to my ears. And that's something that you can do a little bit of, and you can do a little research on that. And I will say that, though, a lot of the new records don't do a great job of really advertising, is it from audio, was it from analog to analog to analog, or was there a digital mix in there that then got put back into, you know, to an analog mastering. And so some of that is a little iffy, to be completely honest.
How do you know the difference? You're a record consumer. You're out there looking at your options.
Yeah, exactly. Some record companies will label that on the outside, but many don't. And I think that I will tell you that there's a lot of great audiophile editions out there in the world, and you can do a little research in like modern music on vinyl and modern vinyl, and those people do a really good job with their reissues. And so just a little bit of research on a high-end collection like that, you will not have a problem figuring it out.
What's interesting, though, when you're talking about the Beatles the way your parents heard them, your parents chances are heard the American versions, and when Capitol Records reissued the recordings that were done in England of the Beatles, they put on reverb. And they didn't do it maliciously like Dave Marsh alleged. They did it to everything. They put reverb on everything. It was just the fashion of the day. When I first started collecting when I collected Beatle records, I would always go over to Capers and buy the imports, the English imports, because they sounded better. And it's truer to where what they sounded like. It's just true audio. For the Stones, give me a mono early recording. Those early recordings, give me a mono.
Why?
They just sound better. because they were originally recorded mono, and then they were electrically transferred into stereo. There's all kinds of little tricks you learn over the years when you're record collecting.
Yeah, I tried to take a shortcut with today's hour-long show, I guess. That's all the time we have for today's Central Standard. It's been fun chatting with all of our guests and listeners. Chuck Haddix of the Fish Fry and Mars Sound Archive. It's been great sharing the studio with you this morning.
Good to sit down here. I think the spirit of Walt is here today.
I hope so. Judy Mills of Mills Record Company, thanks for taking the time to visit with
us. Thank you for asking me.
And Alan Henry of Lifehacker, thanks for helping our listeners with their music hacking.
Oh, thanks for having me.
To listen back to today's show or any other discussions you've heard on Central Standard, just go to kcur.org/Central Standard. Sign up for our podcast while you're there. And don't forget you can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @KCURCST. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. Patrick Quick brought us the sound from Mills Record Company at the beginning of the show. I'm Gina Kaufman. The standard's been set. Stick around for Up to Date next.